I would certainly wouldn't mind seeing some smaller bills in the future about some of these issues, because they are important and we can, you know, talk about the policies. But, you know, if they're all slopped together in one 46-page bill, it gets really hard to split those hairs and get that nuance.
Major environmental legislation became law this week through veto overrides, but the legislative process makes it hard to keep track of the details. From Newland to New Bern, you're listening to the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Colin Campbell, WUNC's Capitol Bureau Chief. This week, state legislators returned to Raleigh for a one-day session to override five of Governor Roy Cooper's vetoes. The votes bring the total of overridden vetoes this year to 19, a new record for the number of overrides in a single year. Most of the focus this week was on the vetoed bills that change the rules for elections and take appointment powers away from the governor. Those bills already have triggered lawsuits from Democrats, voting rights groups, and Governor Roy Cooper. But two other bills got less attention, in part because they're so complicated. It's hard to summarize the 46-page regulatory reform bill in just a few sentences on the radio, although I tried my best this week. The 17-page clean energy bill also isn't exactly simple. So to dig into the details, I'm joined by Grady O'Brien. He's a policy associate at the North Carolina Conservation Network, a partnership between more than 60 environmental and conservation groups across the state. He previously worked as a legislative aide for Representative Cecil Brockman, a Democrat from High Point. Grady, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the regulatory reform bill. In his veto message, Governor Roy Cooper called it, quote, a hodgepodge of bad provisions that will result in dirtier water, discriminatory permitting, and threats to North Carolina's environment. What provisions in this bill stood out to you from an environmental standpoint?
Yeah, the tough thing about reg reform is, like the governor said, it tends to be kind of a quilted patchwork of things, and you really have to dive into the text there. I think the three big ones that I would point out is, you know, Section 7 seemed to create a fast track for the MVP Southgate project, the Mountain Valley Pipeline gas project that would bring that into the northern part of the state. It would do so by kind of putting tailoring a water quality certification that DEQ has to grant to federally permitted projects, and by saying, you know, they have to approve it within a certain amount of days, they have to deem it complete within a certain amount of days, and kind of narrowly tailoring how they would be able to deny it if they wanted to deny it. And there's some federal rulemaking going on about the 401 program right now, actually, that would kind of give states guidelines that isn't finished yet and would be something we maybe wanted to wait for before we tailor this specific section of the bill to this specific project and kind of give it a carve out.
Yeah, so this is sort of bubbled up to a national issue, I believe, right? It was Virginia, if memory serves, that blocked construction of the Mountain Valley Pipeline. It's supposed to be natural gas from West Virginia to North Carolina, right?
I believe so. I think the project had some permit issues in Virginia as well.
Yeah, and that resulted in it not moving ahead here, but then Congress took some action, sort of put it back into a viability from a permitting standpoint at that level. So I guess this is the goal here, is to make sure that nothing in North Carolina holds this up and to make some carve outs specific to this project.
Yeah, pretty much. There's plenty of momentum around kind of creating a runway for this thing to land, even if, you know, again, we're tailoring water quality certifications that should be, you know, well considered and have enough time to be looked over, especially for a complex project like MVP, like you said, that's coming from West Virginia through Virginia down here. You know, DEQ might need more than those 90 days. So to tailor it so specifically, and I think, you know, some of the bill sponsors were pretty clear that it was because of MVP Southgate in particular, you know, that might not be the best way forward on our 401 water quality certification program.
Had there been concerns raised in the communities that this passes through before in the years that this has been on the drawing board as a possible pipeline project?
I believe so. I don't know quite as much about that, but I know that there's worry about, you know, where it's going to impact, you know, the northern part of the state and certainly the kind of western part of Virginia.
Other things in there that struck you? I know some talk about hog lagoons seemed to be one of the issues that bubbled up.
Yeah, there was, again, some tailoring of how DEQ would have to put conditions or deny permits for animal waste systems that would really kind of hew them into just parts of our general statutes, which kind of might conflict with civil rights law. You know, DEQ receives federal funding, and any entity that receives federal funding has to comply by Title VI of the Civil Rights Act and make sure they're not making discriminatory decisions or impacts. But by kind of writing this language, it seems to conflict by saying, no, you can only deny or put conditions based on what we've written in our general statutes and not kind of consider these other factors that, you know, might go into water quality and the water degradation impacts.
Is there concern from the pork industry that the civil rights language at the federal level could give DAQ an interpretation where they could say, look at this neighboring community, it's predominantly minority, you can't have a permit, you can't build the hog lagoons here?
I think that could very well be their concern, but, you know, civil rights law is civil rights law, and, you know, the DEQ and any other agency that receives federal money needs to be, you know, considering those things so they're not having discriminatory impacts when they make their decisions.
When I asked the Port Council about this, their response was that this is sort of codifying the way DEQ already handles that. Is there anything to support that this is already being done this way, or...
I've heard that as well. I'm not a litigator, so I don't know if, you know, going looking at the lawsuits around some of these decisions, you know, if that's necessarily true. But I know the way it's written seems to conflict and say that, you know, we're only looking at this part of our general statutes in North Carolina and nothing else should be used to deny or put conditions on a permit. So,
any other environmental points of concern in this huge bill? I assume the bouncy houses is probably okay, but other than that, you know.
Yeah, you know, the bouncy houses I'm fine with. I've got a 13-month-old daughter, so I'm sure she'll be there soon. You know, the stormwater stuff at the beginning, stormwater is very complex. There's kind of a lot of, you know, different regulations out there, but, you know, it's a tough topic and it's an important one. You know, stormwater is not properly managed. You get flooding, you get sedimentation problems, you get erosion on stream banks, you get too many nutrients in your water. So these are important kind of little parts of our regulatory framework, and every little chip away at that kind of weakens it. And then you know, look down the line and you see those impacts like flooding or sediment in water, and you can say, well, you know, we might need some stronger tactics there to make sure that doesn't happen. But this takes a few shots at that in the first few sections that might be concerning down the line.
Is this sort of the sort of piecemeal approach to this, where it may not be this one change that really, you know, changes the waterfront as far as how stormwater permitting functions, but because there's been a series of things that, as you mentioned, chip away at this, that's sort of where the concern arises?
Yeah, not to be too cliche, but it is the kind of death by a thousand cuts, where, you know, every little change, you know, opens up the possibility for, you know, more untreated stormwater. Like I said, you know, you'll see news articles of, you know, creeks or whatever that look orange because of all the sediment and things like that. So, and you can't necessarily point to, oh, this is the one exact change that did it. But, you know, the improper stormwater management usually leads to those things.
Who pushes for these typically? Is this the Home Builders Association or other sort of construction groups that want to have a few fewer hurdles to deal with as they build all over the state?
I do think there's been, during this session, some advocacy from those organizations. These ones in this bill particular, I'm not going to claim to know who pushed to get them in, but I think generally the regulated community that has to follow them wants some sort of, you know, relief. But again, these are important things to protect communities from flooding, protect stream quality, water quality. So
there's a ton of provisions in this bill. Were there any positives that you see from an environmental standpoint?
You know, there's one about encapsulating polystyrene docks to make sure there's less polystyrene, which is the kind of generic term for styrofoam, getting into our coastal waters. So that is good. You know, there's things in here that I guess you can be encouraged by. But kind of those big ones about, you know, Mountain Valley Pipeline, gas pipeline, and civil rights conflicts, you know, those really stick out when you're reading through this.
There were several versions of this bill along the way. As these things tend to do, things come in, they come out. Anything that got removed from the final version that you guys were happy about? I know there was some concerns initially about a provision dealing with PFAS standards in water.
Yeah, I think there was a section that was going to pretty well limit the use of narrative standards, which are, as opposed to like a defined numeric standard, is sometimes used for emerging compounds where there's less known or less regulated in our regulatory framework or our rules. And so those are used when, you know, a contaminant of concern pops up. And that was troubling to see, that we might not be able to use those standards and permits when they're allowed by the Clean Water Act and sometimes necessitated by it. So,
yeah, that seemed like if that had moved forward, that would be sort of a giveaway to Kim Orr or any of these other potential polluters of PFAS into the waterways in eastern North Carolina.
Yeah, essentially, you know, unless we went through the rulemaking process to put that very specific numeric calculation in rule, you know, there wouldn't be much that DEQ or other permitting agencies would have been done to stop that.
Yeah, so I guess that got pulled out at the end. Anyone really say why, or did it just kind of...
I think, you know, some environmental and PFAS toxics advocates, you know, took that issue to folks and said, you know, this might be written in a way that isn't on your radar, but, you know, you need to look at this because it's really going to hamper, you know, the communities that have been most impacted, whether it's, you know, Wilmington and down Cape Fear Way or some of the new ones.
Yeah, I get the sense that's one sort of environmental area of concern that seems to have bipartisan interest where because of what happened in the Cape Fear River Basin, there's a lot more recognition that, you know, you've got to be treading carefully, right?
Yeah, for sure. If all politics is local, when it's in your drinking water, you're going to pay attention and perk up. So,
well, there's also a lot in this bill that doesn't really relate to the environment necessarily or to much of anything else that's in the bill. Here's the bill sponsor, Republican Representative Dennis Riddell of Alamance County, going through the laundry list of topics during Tuesday's floor session.
Friends, what's before you in this bill, as occurs in every reg reform bill, is quite an eclectic grouping of issues. We deal with stormwater, we deal with phased-in fish mandatory reporting, dredging, narrative water quality studies, flotation devices, nutrient offsets, total maximum daily loads, brownfields, homeschool co-ops, Raleigh-Durham Airport, HOAs, online marketplaces, food establishments and inspections, DIT's procurement policies, piers and docks, reverting back to the 2009 building code, emergency supply train matters, charter schools and water sewer capacity, OAH and the codifier of rules to remove repealed rules. We also are modifying transliterators and their licensing requirements. We are finally giving recognition to Civil Air Patrol senior members and giving them some protection for having to be out of work when they're on station. Raffle prizes cap is increased. We raised the maximum vehicle height from 13 feet 6 inches to 14 feet. There's also a hospital issue. And for those of you that need a little fun, we're also dealing with inflatable amusement devices.
So that explanation is enough to make your head spin or your eyes glaze over, depending on how much of that anyone who's not in one of these industries actually understands the terminology he was using. But we see a similarly, I guess we'll say eclectic, to use Riddell's description, mishmash of things in regulatory reform every single session, usually popping up kind of at the end of session, which is where we are now. From a process standpoint, is this the right approach to this sort of stuff, or should these provisions be getting split into separate measures?
You know, just as somebody who has to read all these things and summarize them, and it, like you said, we're an affiliate organization, so we have 60 groups, so I try to cover a lot of different topics when I'm, you know, summarizing and alerting people. So, yeah, I'd like to see some of these things teased out and are argued and debated individually, because I think when you pile too many of them up, it just becomes kind of a big pro-con thing, and I don't know if that's the best way to deal with some of these issues of just balancing, you know, what do I want to vote for against, you know, the negatives. So, yeah, I would certainly wouldn't mind seeing some smaller bills in the future about some of these issues, because they are important and we can, you know, talk about the policies. But, you know, if they're all slopped together in one 46-page bill, it gets really hard to split those hairs and get that nuance.
Yeah, and then just less opportunity to debate and have a, you know, impact. I mean, this sort of feels to me, as I watch this every year, as it's like this fast-moving train that everyone seems to agree has to pass for whatever reason. And so everything just gets tacked onto that. Is that your impression as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think this bill definitely grew over the iterations of it. So, yeah, I mean, it can be a convenient place if you're a legislator and you have a little idea that you need stuck in somewhere. But, no, going forward, I wouldn't mind, again, a few separate bills, maybe one just on the environmental, and so we're not, you know, conflated with the bounce houses and minor league baseball or whatever. I'm not sure if that ended up in there.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to track them all. And yeah, there's also, I mean, regulatory reform is this catch-all. Although I think it's described at one point in the bill as regulatory relief, which is, yeah, I guess, sort of goes to a philosophy that all regulations are perhaps bad and, you know, put, yeah, pressure on you that should be relieved.
That's certainly how some folks view it. But, you know, I would argue that there's some good regulation out there that protects folks and the environment.
Moving now to one of the other bills that became law this week through a veto override. This one makes what might seem like a small word change in state law, essentially just replacing the phrase renewable energy with clean energy in a lot of the utilities regulations that's there. What does this change ultimately mean for our state's utility regulations and particularly the state's carbon reduction goals?
Yeah, I think the two concerns with this bill, you know, from a clean energy standpoint are One, there was actually a good provision that was removed at the end that would have increased the amount of third-party leasing that could happen in the state. Right now, it's capped at a figure of 1% of a certain calculation.
That's for solar installations, right?
Yeah. And that was going to be that, you know, folks could lease this from a from another vendor and have it and benefit from it. That cap was going to be up to about 10%. That was taken out of the bill. I think there were a lot of advocates who would have liked to see that in there because it's kind of just an artificial cap. I don't think any other state really has that. So that good provision coming out is concerning. And then the other thing was there was some language struck at the end that essentially said, you know, if you're going to the Utilities Commission to say we want to build new generation, the Utilities Commission would have had to look at things like, well, can energy efficiency, demand-side management, renewable generation, are all of those things, enough to outbalance you building a new facility? Could those be, you know, more cost-effective, better for generation? And that's been struck to say, you know, we're just going to build whatever goes along, I think, with the carbon plan. So kind of taking those out was a little concerning because, you know, those are all really important parts of the carbon reduction, the emissions reduction goals is, you know, energy efficiency, demand side management, renewables. Those are going to play a big part. And so the Utilities Commission having that language struck that they're not supposed to really consider it explicitly or have it enumerated, I think is concerning.
Is this all about allowing more nuclear power as part of the overall mix as we move away from, you know, traditional fossil fuels?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think the first iteration of the bill was just kind of that find and replace of calling renewable clean and making sure nuclear was stuck under there. And, you know, I think as we go forward, if we ever revisit the renewable portfolio standard, which I think was established in 2007, it's been a while, you know, the nuclear generation can really bigfoot some of those other renewables like solar and wind and what have you. So, you know, being stuck in there is clean. And I think, you know, there are arguments on the floor by some folks that, you know, clean, sure, it's not carbon generating, and that is excellent. But, you know, there's waste from nuclear. You know, there's other things to consider, especially the cost as well. So it does seem like a way of, you know, shoving nuclear into this category in a, you know, portfolio standard that was meant for renewables, that was meant to really upstart the use of things like solar.
Here's the bill sponsor for this, Republican Senator Paul Newton of Concord, explaining why he thinks the change will save money for electricity customers.
Despite the fact that we enjoy electric rates in North Carolina that are well below the national average, the poorest families in North Carolina already pay more than 20% of their household income just for electricity. The clean energy sections of Senate Bill 678 that the governor rejected will help us reach our energy goals cost-effectively, more cost-effectively, and ensure North Carolinians can afford this basic human need of electricity as we move towards a cleaner energy future. I submit that if you want to meet the ambitious carbon reduction goals in House Bill 951 as cost-effectively as possible, if you care about the cost burden and minimizing the cost burden of the clean energy transition on the poor, you will vote in favor of this motion.
So do you buy that argument that by adding more nuclear to the mix, this shift to a more carbon neutral future will be less costly in terms of electric rates?
You know, I mean, I think we all want to see ratepayers pay less and, you know, not be spending an exorbitant amount of their income on their energy bills. And there's programs that help that, that we could certainly supplement. You know, I don't think anything that was struck from the language about the Utilities Commission, again, factoring energy efficiency, factoring renewable production, that, you know, I don't think striking those is going to all of a sudden make things, you know, much more cost effective. You know, if nuclear is part of it, the Utilities Commission can make that decision. But, you know, with the rapidly kind of competitive pricing of things like solar and battery storage and, you know, eventually wind and offshore wind, you know, those should get just as much consideration as, you know, trying to artificially put nuclear out there.
What's the rationale behind doing it that way? I mean, just looking broadly at the country, we haven't seen that many new nuclear power plants built, I think, anywhere in the last few decades. And there's been a shift away from that. Is there now a shift back towards that in the utility world?
I think there's been some speculation over new forms of nuclear, small modular reactors, advanced reactors. I don't know if any of those are, you know, I'm not an expert in those sorts of technologies, so I don't know if any of those are ready yet. But I think it could be laying the groundwork of saying, well, you know, the speculative industry out there that, that might be coming up with new things, as opposed to kind of the big nuclear facility that we all picture when we think about it. You know, that's could be the rationale behind the bill, is making sure that that's, you know, has a place in the future. But again, the renewable portfolio standard, the intention of it at the time was really, you know, to get solar integrated into these generation mixes. And so kind of throwing nuclear in on top of it, whether it has a future or not, with the Utilities Commission making those decisions, you know, it might just not be the most prudent way forward.
Is it a concern this was paired with that lack of having that extra flexibility around solar that was originally in the bill? And was there any sense given for why that came out?
Yeah, I mean, I think the bill sponsor did not particularly like that provision. It was actually, I think, originally in a House bill from Representative Kyle Hall, and then it got slid into this one and then eventually taken out. So I don't think, you know, Senator Newton, as you played the clip, I don't think he was in favor of it. So I think that's why it came out.
Yeah, and it's, I guess, worth noting here that he is a former Duke Energy executive. The clip that we played is fairly similar argument in favor of the bill that we saw from Duke Energy itself into why the utility was in favor of this particular thing. So do you worry that the existing utility players are having a lot of influence on how this, you know, shift towards the future as far as, you know, carbon emissions goes?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the hopefully the Utilities Commission will take, you know, everybody's side into account. And, you know, the utilities one is important. They have to do that work. But, you know, the folks who are trying to, you know, push for those carbon reduction goals, they're now in statute and make sure, you know, there's plenty of people out there thinking about ratepayers, you know, so I'm glad to hear them talking about it. That's wonderful. But, you know, there's a lot of ideas out there on how to benefit low-income ratepayers and or medium-income ratepayers. So, you know, there's a lot of different sides of the story. You know, Duke Energy certainly is one of them, but, you know, we need to make sure we're considering all stakeholders, because, you know, this is the future of energy for the entire state and for ratepayers, in, you know, environmental groups and the utilities alike.
I want to jump back to that solar provision a little bit. So the cap that's there, I mean, is this talking about commercially driven solar installations? Are we talking about residential as well? How exactly does that cap work in statute now?
I believe it can be either residential or commercial. There's a term of art that I can't say, that I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's something about the peak demand. And there's, if you take 1% of that, that's the amount you can lease through solar. And so they were going to increase that to 10, which obviously tenfold increase. And again, I think we're the only state that puts that cap on there. So it's just kind of an artificial way of saying, you know, we could eventually hit a point where if you're one of these third party solar providers and you want to get into business in the state, you might quickly run up against a cap that
they can say, we're full, we don't need that, don't build it.
Exactly. And so, you know, if that's kind of the market you're looking at, you might go elsewhere and say, well, you know, we'll go to a state that doesn't have that. So again, I think, you know, some of the arguments were, well, we haven't even hit that cap yet. Well, we haven't yet, but we could. And should it be there if it's just artificially limiting the ability of people to say, you know, I want solar on my house, but the best way for me to do it is go and lease it from a third party and you make those payments like you would with kind of any improvement. So
Any other environmental legislation that sort of came up in your radar in this portion of session? I know the budget had a few things in it that raised concerns, but maybe didn't get quite as much attention, because the budget was also a 600-page bill to sort through with a lot of policy stuff in it.
Yeah, 600 pages there, and I think a 700-page money report. So, yeah, I mean, a couple of pet issues I work on. One is plastic waste reduction, and there was some language in the budget which prohibited cities or counties from adopting ordinances to regulate, you know, plastic waste from, whether it's, you know, grocery bags, plastic containers, bottles, foodware, all sorts of things that are single use, get thrown away, maybe don't get recycled efficiently, and then end up in our waterways, you know, litter by the side of the street, breaking down to microplastics, which is becoming an issue. So, and there were some local governments who were looking at some policies. They weren't quite there yet, but I think they were going through and assessing what they could do for their local communities. And we actually did have a bag ban at the Outer Banks for quite a while, I think about 8 or 9 years before it was repealed. So, you know, there's precedent for those kind of things, but with this language, it's not going to be possible anymore. And, you know, I think anytime you talk about the General Assembly removing local power, you're talking about, you know, folks who know their communities, folks who are elected to do what's right for, you know, their county or their city, and they don't have that tool at their disposal anymore.
Yeah, so it seemed like just the mere suggestion that this was being considered, because as you mentioned, none of these towns had actually enacted any sort of plastic bag ban or mm-hmm. a tax or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if people started to see, you know, city council deliberations over these things and stepped in to say, you know, we can't have that. But yeah, it's again, it's solving a quote unquote problem, not actually a problem, but solving it before was there. And so it's a little disappointing to see from the advocacy side of plastic waste reduction, because, you know, lowering consumption, lowering waste, you know, how these things are thrown away and end up, again, in waterways, breaking down to microplastics, ending up in our blood and our lungs and things like that. You know, we're going to need to take some steps on that. And again, taking that tool out of the toolbox is, you know, probably not the best way forward.
Is this ultimately going to now, unless the legislature has a change of heart on this issue, going to come down to individual retailers? I mean, I think going grocery shopping, you go to a place like Aldi and they make you buy the plastic bags or bring your own. You go to a Food Lion or one of the more traditional grocery stores, yeah. The default is always we're going to put your stuff in plastic bags unless you tell us otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there will probably be, you know, pushes to have some voluntary, you know, participation in waste reduction, and all that stuff is great and fine. But, you know, when you look from a policy landscape, you'd like to have, again, local elected officials be able to say, you know, what's best for our community and are we facing an issue with plastic and too much waste? So, yeah, I think voluntary, there's still, you know, procurement policies that maybe can be tweaked to say, you know, at least we're not, you know, generating as much plastic. But, yeah, that ordinance, that regulatory aspect has been taken away.
And you also have been looking, as have I, to the pretty massive infusion into utility infrastructure in the state, $2 billion in the budget allocated to specific towns with specific dollar figures. Is that a concern as to how that was handled versus other ways you could have done that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, $2 billion is not only necessary for our water and sewer infrastructure. I mean, you know, it's we need more than that. Where if you look at, you know, the Division of Water Infrastructure has a master plan that says we're going to need probably $20 billion over the next, I think, decade or two. So it's great to see money spent on that and that become a priority. But, you know, we also do have a Division of Water Infrastructure that sets up, you know, programs and processes to distribute money to the folks that demonstrate the most need. And they even go ahead and designate certain areas as distressed because, you know, they're infrastructure is just too old, or, you know, they're having trouble being solvent with their rates and their debt and things like that. And so we have these really good systems to say, you know, there are places out there that need this the most and have projects that they've, you know, thought out. And when you kind of go through the earmark process, we don't know as much about that. So, you know, not to quibble with any individual project, these might, you know, end up being really good use of money, but it's not really guaranteed when we do have entities like the Division of Water Infrastructure and the State Water Infrastructure Authority, which is kind of the oversight board that finalizes all those funding decisions and hands out grants and loans. You know, they do a lot of great work. They've, you know, meticulously and really made well thought out decisions on how that should happen. So to then, you know, throw nearly $2 billion in earmarks where there's not a lot of descriptions of what these projects will be. You know, these towns will get money, and I really do hope they spend it well and you know, improve their water and sewer, but we just don't know.
Yeah, my impression in reporting on this was a lot of these were dollar figures that the towns themselves had submitted, but some of them, I talked to one of folks down in Pine Bluff in Moore County, and they're sort of in an early phase of recognizing they need to replace all their pipes, but they've got to do the study first. And so the dollar figure that they end up getting was sort of their estimate of what it might cost, but they don't really know yet until they've done some surveying. And I sort of wonder if that's the case for some of these other places, was that they came up with the figure on their own, but wasn't necessarily like the figure that they might eventually arrive at, or that the state would have come through some sort of competitive grant process.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, again, not to get too in the weeds, but, you know, there's asset management, and there's capital improvement plans, and there's all these things that local governments do to make sure, you know, they're spending their tax dollars prudently, so that, you know, if they have to go get a grant or a loan from the state, they're doing that as well. And again, that's all the great work that Division of Water Infrastructure and State Water Infrastructure Authority do. And, you know, to bypass that with $1.9 billion, that again is so very necessary, so great to see it going towards these things. But, you know, again, from a policy perspective, those processes are there and they're pretty well refined. So would have liked to have seen it go that way.
Yeah, well, as we wrap up, I always like to end on sort of a lighter note. Your organization has tentacles all over the state with different organizations you're involved in. What are some of your favorite places to visit around North Carolina when you're able to get outside of Raleigh?
Well, I have the good fortune of tomorrow going out to Beaufort to the Duke Marine Lab to participate in a marine debris symposium. So I'll actually be talking more about plastics, which is great. And not to make too many enemies on my first podcast appearance, but I went to Duke and I got to go to the Marine Lab when I was a student there. So I'll be revisiting there for the first time. And that'll be fun because I remember it as being a really beautiful place and a really nice place to be. So.
Yeah, so all the coastal towns are just really fun to visit and all have their own little sort of personalities.
Yep.
Grady O'Brien is the policy associate at the North Carolina Conservation Network. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this week's podcast. If you have any feedback, feel free to reach out to me through our website, wunc.org. I'm Colin Campbell. Thanks for listening.